Stage 9. Mental and physical pliancy and calming the intensity of meditative joy. 9. The goal of Stage 9 is the maturation of meditative joy that produces tranquility and equanimity. As you continue to practice, simply abiding in the state of meditative joy will cause profound tranquility and equanimity to arise. In Stages 9 and 10, you fully unify the mind, moving from a state of highly excited meditative joy and happiness to one of serene joy and happiness. The resulting shamatha has 5 qualities of mind: fully stable attention, powerful mindfulness, joy, tranquility, and equanimity. Although meditation experiences in these final stages are quite consistent from one person to the next, they are often described in very different ways, partly because it's hard to put such rare, subtle experiences into familiar terms. The other reason is that people explain their experiences according to the diverse conceptual models provided by the particular traditions they follow. However, as your practice progresses, you will start recognizing the common experiences these various descriptions all point toward. Here we give a general description, using only the conceptual models we've introduced in this book, while avoiding the unique particulars belonging to specific traditions. Practice goals for Stage 9. You've reached Stage 9 when there's complete pacification of the senses and fully developed meditative joy. This means that almost every time you sit, you can enter a state of mental and physical pliancy, accompanied by the blisses of mental and physical pliancy. This is also called Grade 5, or pervading piti, which you experience as circulating energy, physical comfort, pleasure, stability, and intense joy. Although you can regularly achieve this grade of piti, each time you do, the growing intensity of the joy and energy of the experience inevitably disrupts it. The goal of Stage 9 is for meditative joy to mature completely, and for piti to subside in intensity. You accomplish this by repeatedly reaching Grade 5 piti and sustaining it for as long as you can. Other than that, you just have to stay out of the way while continuing to practice. When you can stay with the piti long enough, allowing unification to proceed and joy to mature, piti eventually gives way to tranquility and equanimity. This is the essence of Stage 9 practice. Piti as an inclusive term. We use piti in these final stages as an inclusive term that captures a lot of complexity in a succinct way. It will be helpful to remember everything this umbrella term includes: full pacification of the senses, along with physical pliancy, and the bliss of physical pliancy, and meditative joy, along with mental pliancy, and the bliss of mental pliancy. Calming piti and maturing joy. For the intensity of piti to calm, you need to be able to sustain it until the intensity peaks and starts to subside, giving way to tranquility and equanimity. At first, Grade 5 piti can't be sustained very long at all, because physical pliancy is so novel, interesting, and enjoyable. And the highly energized, excited state of Grade 5 piti makes potential distractions, such as altered body perception, illumination, and inner sound, even more potent. Competing intentions to attend to these phenomena repeatedly succeed in disrupting the consensus to attend exclusively to the breath. The excitement can also produce a powerful, restless urge to get up and share your experience with someone. It's also common to mistake the intense joy, inner light, and transformed perception of the body for something more exalted. The ebullient satisfaction of meditative joy may make you think, "I've arrived. What more could I want? This is it." Remember, joy affects not only how we feel in response to experiences, but also how we perceive and interpret them. Enjoy these positive qualities, but don't be misled by them. To deal with these distractions, urges, and misperceptions, recognize them for what they are, and just let them come, let them be, and let them go. Yes, you'll likely give in a few times at first, but as soon as the euphoria subsides, return to the practice with a firm resolve to ignore whatever arises. On the positive side, these disruptions let you practice regaining piti after you've lost it. An adept meditator at this stage can usually overcome these problems quickly and easily, and stay with the piti longer. However, the better you are at ignoring these potential disruptions, and the longer you succeed in sustaining grade 5 piti, the more intense the mental energy associated with joy becomes. This is because ignoring them further unifies the mind, making even more energy available. In turn, the increased energy makes the joy more buzzy and frenetic until the very intensity of the experience disrupts the piti again. Your greatest challenge in this stage is that the mental energy keeps increasing until you can't even stay focused enough to sustain mental and physical pliancy. The solution is just to be resolute and persevere in your practice. When you falter, re-enter the state of pervasive piti and keep your attention on the breath while ignoring the energy and excitement. It's the same as when you pacified the discriminating mind and the senses. The conscious intention to let these things remain in awareness, combined with the firm resolve to ignore them with attention, allows the mind to unify and transforms how the mind system functions. So, practice at this stage is really quite simple. Achieve piti, sustain it for as long as possible, and start over when you lose it. Eventually, you can sustain piti long enough for its intensity to peak and begin subsiding. Subjectively, it seems like you just get used to the intensity of the piti, that it subsides because you've become familiar with it. At a deeper level, it's because the mind system continues to unify. The same energy that once caused disruption now gets channeled into stabilizing the entire mind system. Once that happens, you can usually sustain a state of tranquil piti for the rest of the sit. With continued practice, you won't just get used to the initial energy and excitement, but the peak will grow less intense as well. It eventually becomes more of a bump, easy to traverse, followed by even stronger tranquility. Sometimes, especially in retreats, the bump disappears completely, and you slide right into tranquility and equanimity. What subsides first is the bliss of physical pliancy, the deliciously pleasurable physical sensation that pervades the body. It doesn't disappear completely, but it recedes into the background. However, the stable, comfortable, and pain-free condition of physical pliancy doesn't change. Next, the coarseness of the bliss of mental pliancy, its energetic, agitated quality, disappears, replaced by a serene happiness and tranquility. It's a lot like a post-orgasmic state. Physical pleasure has subsided, but a residue remains, and the intensity and excitement have also faded, but the joy and happiness persist. Useful practices for calming piti and maturing joy. By repeatedly focusing your attention on the breath and ignoring everything else, you can sustain piti, allowing joy to mature as the mind grows unified. However, if you've been practicing the luminous jhanas, you can speed up your progress by regularly moving through the higher luminous jhanas. The second jhana has the same quality of mental excitement and intensity as a completed stage 8 and early stage 9, but with the greater stability of absorption. Moving to the third jhana is just like successfully achieving the goal of stage 9. The intensity and agitation are gone, and there is only a serene pleasure and happiness. The fourth luminous jhana is like stage 10, with only tranquility and equanimity. Therefore, these jhanas can help habituate you to the calm piti of the mature form of joy. Other practices that can help calm piti have the added benefit of being conducive to insight. These include the meditation on dependent arising, and finding the still point and realizing the witness. Another extremely powerful practice for calming piti and generating insight is meditating on the mind. Meditating on the mind. Meditating on the mind itself involves bringing attention and awareness together in a completely open state. Essentially, you're fusing attention and awareness. To achieve this, you expand your scope of attention until it includes everything in your field of conscious awareness, both extrospective and introspective. This is similar to how you expanded your scope of attention to include the whole body in stage 6, except that you're expanding it to include much, much more than just bodily sensations. And, as with the whole body practice, the amount of conscious power required for attention to encompass so much is enormous. That means much of the excess mental energy made available through unification can get put to immediate use instead of just agitating the mind. Start either from the still point or from an exclusive focus on the breath with strong metacognitive awareness. Expand your scope of attention gradually at first. You're working against the natural tendency for attention to contract around a particular object, so each time you expand the scope a little more, rest for a while in that larger, more open space. Make sure that everything within that scope is perceived with equal clarity before moving ahead. Whether you start with the attention focused on the still point or the breath, awareness should be almost entirely metacognitive. When you expand the scope of attention until it includes everything in awareness, the entire field of conscious awareness is the focus of attention. The object of meditation is the mind itself, and the distinction between attention and awareness disappears. As you know from the practices you did in Stage 8, metacognitive awareness can include extrospective content. In other words, you can be metacognitively aware of external sensory information passing through the mind. Therefore, allow your mind to project both sensations and purely mental objects into consciousness. Hold a clear intention to allow things to come and go in peripheral awareness, but in a slow and gentle way rather than as a flood. Attention will still try to contract around specific objects, so practice catching that impulse as soon as each new thought or sensation arises, and immediately release attention before it can zoom in. You'll eventually have the sense that attention and awareness have merged and become indistinguishable. The holistic quality of awareness and the analytic precision of attention are both fully present. The mind has become a well-tuned and powerful instrument, capable of simultaneously observing individual objects and their relationship to the entire field of conscious awareness. This is an extremely clear perception that takes place within a vast, open mental space. As you observe the mind with great clarity, you start distinguishing between two fundamental states of consciousness. The first is where the mind is active. Specific sensations and mental objects are being projected into the field of conscious awareness by unconscious sub-minds. The other is a state of comparative rest, where no cognizable objects are present, and the space-like field of conscious awareness lies still and empty. Your objective is to investigate the nature of the mind by comparing the active and resting receptive states. The main purpose of this practice, for this stage, is to generate stable, consistent tranquility and equanimity. Yet it's also extremely effective at producing insight. Indeed, some adepts use it as their primary technique for investigating the mind. The description of the mind in a resting state may sound like the cessation event discussed in the 7th interlude. To be clear, they are not the same. This is not cessation, and consciousness does have content, just not a cognizable object. However, this investigation can give rise to the same insights as the cessation experience. Insight, emptiness, and the nature of mind. By observing the nature of mind in both its active and passive states, it eventually becomes clear that all objects of consciousness are constructs of the mind. All we've ever known is what the mind itself has produced. The true nature of these mind-made objects of consciousness is simply the nature of mind itself. You may have already grasped this intellectually, but you now experience it directly. True, there may have been some external stimulus that caused your unconscious sub-mind to project a particular object into consciousness, but all we can ever observe is the mental object, a product of the mind itself, not the source of the original stimulus. To put it another way, the thing in itself that stimulated the mind to produce the object can never be observed. The mind creates its own reality, made entirely of cognitive, emotional constructs produced in response to unknown and ultimately unknowable forces acting on the mind through the senses. Furthermore, the perceived appearance of these constructs has far more to do with the nature of the constructing mind than with the actual sources of sensory data. The one thing we can be sure of is that the true nature of that unknown source is quite different from anything the mind projects. This is what is referred to as the emptiness of all phenomena. The objects of consciousness arising and passing away in the mind are like waves rising and disappearing on the ocean surface. Just as the waves have no existence apart from the ocean, arising due to forces acting on the ocean, so, too, with the contents of consciousness and the mind. The ego self, that familiar notion of who and what we are, is just another one of those empty mental constructs. So are the egocentric thoughts, emotions, and intentions that arise in consciousness that reinforce belief in the ego self. When you realize your ego self is as empty as any other mental phenomenon, you may be tempted to relocate your sense of personal identity to the mind, or even consciousness itself. However, if you keep practicing this meditation on the mind, you will eventually realize that your perception of the mind at rest is as much a construct as anything else. That is, your subjective experience of watching the mind, and therefore the very idea of the mind as something self-existently real that can be watched, is no different from any other object created by the mind. The mind is as empty as the objects that arise within it. With this further insight, it's no longer possible to believe in your mind as the self. The insight experience triggering this last insight is often a cessation event, and, as with the cessation discussed in the seventh interlude, takes the form of a pure consciousness experience, or consciousness without an object. Our subjective experience of time stops. Consciousness has no object apart from this simple fact of consciousness itself. There is no sense of self in this experience, no witness, nothing. In the words of the Buddha, it is gone to suchness, or in the words of Nisargadatta, I am that. The more you engage in this practice, the deeper this insight will go, penetrating bit by bit, ever deeper into the most hidden recesses of your psyche. For this particular insight experience to occur, a specific constellation of causes and conditions must be present. In addition to stable attention, mindfulness, and joy, you require tranquility, equanimity, investigation, and diligence. The more complete and lasting your shamatha, the more strongly developed these factors are, and the more chance there is for insight to arise. Yet keep in mind, attachment to insight can itself be an impediment. It's far better to surrender all hopes and expectations. Just practice from a place of trust for the sake of whatever your meditation may bring. These insights will come in their own time. Awakening is an accident, but meditating on the mind is a practice that will make you accident-prone. It's especially important not to be deceived by mere intellectual understanding. You may think you got it just by listening to this description. However, many philosophers and scientists have understood this truth intellectually, but it hasn't transformed them. We haven't gotten it until this insight completely transforms the way we perceive the world, especially during challenging times, like when we're in an argument with our boss or partner, in a traffic jam, or when our house burns down. The arising of tranquility and equanimity. When the intensity of piti starts to subside, the mind's energy level doesn't drop. The mind actually has more energy than before, but it's being channeled differently, so the joy is accompanied by a sense of tranquility. The very energy that initially made your meditation so unstable is, in fact, the source of your increased stability. Flowing water provides a helpful analogy. Compare the wide, tranquil, glass-like smoothness of the Ganges to a narrow, roaring mountain stream. Even though the total kinetic energy of the Ganges is far greater, the narrow stream appears more powerful. This is because the constricted, cluttered stream bed produces a disordered, turbulent flow, whereas the Ganges has an orderly, smooth flow through a broad and unobstructed channel. The greater energy of the Ganges has carved a larger channel for itself, clearing obstructions and making the flow of energy far more organized. Before shamatha, the mind is like a wild but powerful mountain stream. There's a state of joy, but the accompanying energy is exuberant and turbulent, which is what gave the bliss of mental pliancy its coarseness. But just as with a river, the turbulent energy of piti eventually opens the inner channels, and the energy flow becomes tranquil and serene. Serenity and tranquility are quite blissful, and as they increase, so does the bliss. When the excitement of piti subsides, and there's enough tranquility, equanimity naturally arises. Equanimity is non-reactivity to pleasure and pain. Joyful tranquility produces equanimity simply because the pleasure and happiness generated within are so fulfilling that you already feel completely satisfied. Likewise, remember that joy not only causes a positive shift in affect, but also changes our perceptions in ways that maximize satisfaction. For both these reasons, we become much less reactive to pleasant and unpleasant events, since there's no need to pursue or avoid anything. In other words, equanimity arises because you're already happy and satisfied. Acting at a deeper level, equanimity also eliminates the tendency to see ourselves and our needs as more important than those of others. Conclusion. You have mastered stage 9, when you consistently achieve stable attention and mindfulness, accompanied by joy and tranquility. Equanimity is also present and grows much stronger in the 10th and final stage. Together, these 5 factors constitute the state of shamatha. However, when you get off the cushion, these qualities all rapidly fade. You're ready now to begin the work of stage 10. Experiencing the mental formations of meditative joy and pleasure, happiness, while breathing in, he trains himself. Experiencing the mental formations of meditative joy and pleasure, happiness, while breathing out, he trains himself. Calming these mental formations while breathing in, he trains himself. Calming these mental formations while breathing out, he trains himself. Anapanasati Sutta.